right, that was Decisions by Outer National. And this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. This week's show is coming at a time when the fate of millions of immigrants living in the U.S. hangs in the balance. In particular, the case of the Dreamers, the people who came to the U.S. as children and received Delayed Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, in 2012, is being heard by the Supreme Court. People who are now adults in the only country they have ever known face the possibility of being hunted down and deported. So, at the back end of the show, I'm going to replay an interview I did almost 2 years ago with a dreamer who had been fighting for a future for all immigrants. Basilisa Alonso is a volunteer with the Our Dream Coalition, and we talked about the arrest of 7 DACA recipients who were arrested while sitting in congressional offices demanding that members of Congress block any spending bill that does not include a clean DREAM Act. Trump had just ended DACA in September of 2017, and despite nonstop promises from both Republicans and Democrats in Congress, the 800,000 DACA immigrants were, and still may be, facing deportation to countries they have never known. And opening the show up as promised, I'm going to be talking with revolutionary artist Dred Scott, continuing the conversation we had as he was getting ready to launch his latest piece, Slave Rebellion Reenactment. And that is all completed right now. All right. Last week, we were talking with artist Dred Scott. And he is the he was the lead artist in a just amazing, amazing event over the weekend. Dred Scott makes revolutionary art to propel history forward. He first received national attention in 1989 when his art became the center of controversy over its transgressive use of the American flag while he was a student at the School of the Arts Institute in Chicago. President G.H.W. Bush called his art disgraceful, and the entire U.S. Senate denounced this work and outlawed it when they passed legislation to protect the flag. On November 8th and 9th of this year, hundreds of reenactors retraced the path of the largest slave rebellion in U.S. history, embodying a story of resistance, freedom, and revolutionary action. And Dred Scott is here to talk with us about what happened. Dred, we're now in the wake of the big event. The art piece that you had of staging a march of basically rebellious slaves along the same route of a slave rebellion back in the early 1800s, the first and the most powerful slave rebellion like that ever in the history of this country. I want to find out what happened with that, because there was a lot of people that, you know, I don't know how much people actually got this thing that this wasn't just sort of a, we're going out and we're marching down, but there was a lot of political meaning behind that. And I wanted to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was a slave rebellion reenactment. It reenacted the largest rebellion of enslaved people in the history of the United States. I mean, there were certainly other rebellions that happened. There was, you know, rebellions that were unsuccessful in Jamaica in the, you know, 1760s. It lasted, you know, a year, Tacky's Rebellion, Tacky's Revolt. There were rebellions in Haiti from 1793 up to 1804, which was successful and created the first black republic in the world. And, you know, there were various slave revolts actually in the United States that were smaller, but this was the largest. In 1811, you know, there was this powerful slave revolt that, you know, had a chance of success, and success would have ended up creating, you know, an African republic in what is now modern-day Louisiana. The aim was to actually seize all of Orleans territory and create a state where people were, slavery would have been outlawed in much the way it was in Haiti. And so we reenacted that, and it wasn't, you know, just a march. It was, you know, we had hundreds of people in period costume from 1811 that were very specific to the time in the region. They didn't all, you know, wear like a uniform. I mean, like, if, you know, some people who were older might remember the 1977 roots and have that as an image of slavery, where everybody kind of wore a burlap sack. And that's, you know, that's just not true. That's not what people would have worn in 1811 in New Orleans. It was much more variety, and including some agency of the enslaved for sort of adorning, you know, particularly the head wraps, the tignons that the women wore. And so we, you know, really paid a lot of attention to details, to both give, you know, the enslaved people their humanity, but also to show them as, you know, agents of change and having self-determination to bring about the most radical ideas of freedom in the United States, more radical ideas than Thomas Jefferson or, you know, George Washington and the U.S. Constitution, which, the, you know, their ideas of freedom were predicated upon owning human beings. And so the radical ideas were, of what freedom and emancipation were in the heads of the enslaved. And so we were embodying that. And, it did, we had machetes and muskets and sickles and sabers to go along with these beautiful costumes. And we marched and chanted onto New Orleans, freedom or death, we're going to end slavery, join us, as well as other chants in Creole and that were, really putting the fighting spirit into what people were doing.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you said join us, that was, were you actually calling on people to join what was happening?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it was partially metaphoric and partially real. I mean, we were prevented by sort of permits to actually encourage people to join us. And so part of the trade-off to get the permits was we had to say that we would not encourage other people to join in. And the police were, in some of the parishes, were actively enforcing that. By the time we got to New Orleans, it became a second line, and people did join in, which was great. But we also metaphorically wanted people to join us, even though physically sometimes they couldn't or certainly couldn't have done it for the duration. We wanted people to catch this spirit and be part of this undertaking of, a fight for liberation in the present and join us, even if they didn't, walk with us, to actually think about what that means to, sort of say you're going to end slavery, and both talking historically, talking in the present about literal slavery, but more importantly, talking about the conditions that people are trapped in, around the world, based on a system that is the inherited the legacy of slavery. And so we want people to join us in abolishing that.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that really got to me too was that as I was reading the stuff that you've put out on it and other things around it, and particularly in relation to the way this march was organized and the way it occurred, I mean, one of the things that was really interesting to me was this point about the juxtaposition of history and the current reality, and I thought that was really important in terms of people it forces people's brains to open up a little bit more in terms of what was going on. That it wasn't just a reenaction of a slave rebellion, but it was actually something, it was that, but it was something much, much more too.
Yeah, that was really important. I mean, that's a theme that's been in my work for a while, how the past both sets the stage for the present, but how it exists in the present in new form. And so, looking at how sort of slave revolts exist in the present is kind of encouraging people to think about. And I do think that in a way we created kind of a liberated space where people did step sort of into the future in a certain sense, but there was both a joy and a militance and an anger and a determination and a free space that existed. But by the time we got to the U.S. Mint, which was the first place we sort of touched base down in the city of New Orleans itself, which in 1811 was a fort that guarded the city of New Orleans. And so that's why we went there. There was an advanced detachment of enslaved people who were trying to seize that fort. And, we wanted to honor that. But we got there, and we had to wait for a little bit for some other, basically the camera crew and the horses that were part of this to get there to continue the march into Congo Square, which is where it was really ending. And people had this fierceness and determination, particularly the women. I mean, there were some women that, had walked 24 miles at that point who were just absolutely ferocious and fierce and determined. And it really was a space where they, and including some, sort of non-binary, queer people that felt that they could both express their anger, but also their joy. And it was really, and be who they were. There was a real space of freedom. And it was, I initiated this project, but it was really a group collaborative process, and other people took it up and made it their own in ways that I did not plan, could not imagine in a certain sense. And it was absolutely beautiful. It was one of the most beautiful spaces I've been in.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with artist Dred Scott about his most recent work, Slave Rebellion Reenactment. One of the things that I, just thinking about this and off of talking to you last week, but, continuing it now and thinking about it over the weekend and stuff, and really, really, really upset that I couldn't be there to watch this thing. It was like, I really wanted to make it, and unfortunately wasn't able to. But I kept thinking about this, a couple of points that you've mentioned in various places. And, the importance. You talked about this, you know, it was an art performance. It wasn't a demonstration. It was an art performance.
Yeah.
And it was about some very heavy things that oftentimes are the subjects of demonstrations, freedom, resistance, hope. But you put it in there in a way that was really very cool, I thought was, and it really struck a different tone to things, which was the importance of acknowledging the power that resides in reimagining your own destiny and the importance of it being a what-if story. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. Well, it's both, I mean, it's a what-if story for the past, but also for the present and future. And so, you know, if this revolt was successful, it would have changed U.S. and world history. I mean, if there were an African republic that existed in what is modern-day Louisiana and on the sort of the then western edge of the United States, before Texas secedes from Mexico, before California is part of the United States, before westward expansion has happened quite the same way, before it actually goes really much west of the Mississippi. If there is a free black state there, which also would pose questions to, you know, enslaved people principally in the south of the United, you know, what was then the United States, would they have rebelled? Where does the U.S. go if it's got, you know, a free republic of people on its doorstep that escaped from bondage in this newly forming country? What else would have happened, and what could the people who were resident in that state, who would be challenging sort of the institution of slavery in a way that up until that point only sort of Haiti had, that there would then be two bastions of free republics that would sort of, you know, it took really another 60 years for slavery to largely be abolished in, you know, the European colonies in the Caribbean and in, you know, South America and in North America. And so how would that have accelerated that? And what would that have meant, you know, even for the development of the economies around, like, say, let's say there are these, you know, let's say it changes history in a way that sort of means that you don't even get capitalism developing the same way, because much of the capitalist production that developed was based on enslavement. The cotton trade, where the U.S. actually had 3/4 of the world's market around that, which then powered the, you know, both the quote unquote industrial revolution, but also the shackling of workers to textile mills in England. You know, and so there would be many, many, many things that could have changed if this had been successful and then gotten deepened. But then how does that, you know, how do people who, like, look at that past and know that history, the what if there, but then the understanding that there were these sort of rebels that, you know, again, were self-determined and had agency, how does that manifest today for people who, I mean, there were many people who were part of this, I mean, you know, sort of reenactment. A lot of the reenactors were in tears at various points, and at the end in particular, and there were a lot of people who were, I mean, you know, some of my favorite people that were reenactors, most of the people came into reenact this project were kind of came through a process where many of them were kind of middle class. Let's just say that they were middle class black people, not necessarily wealthy, and not necessarily upper middle, but they were stable. They had, you know, a stable, you know, working class kind of. But there were some people who were, you know, next to homeless. And they were, you know, treated as equals. There was a guy that was actually had recently done a 10-year bid in prison and got out and was treated with dignity and respect. And for those people to imagine them, and then this, you know, ex-con guy, I mean, he said, look, you know, I was, you know, I just got free from prison and now I'm free. It meant he could stand up and stand a little taller and prouder of the past, but also feel himself as somebody who's an agent of change and sort of helping to both create this artwork, but also thinking about what he could do in the future. And for these people that were, like, you know, virtually homeless, who sometimes would come to the rehearsals that we would have, they would walk there. And we thought initially they were walking because they needed to get walking practice in. But really what it turned out was they were walking because they really didn't have bus fare or gas money, and that there was free food that, you know, we had at some of these places, and that they wanted to be part of that community, and they were accepted as part of it. And so they themselves were like, wait a minute, I could be something in this future that we're kind of creating for sort of a 2-day space. Sort of how you imagine the past and how you think of the past also conditions how you imagine the future and how you see yourself and how you could be. I didn't fully understand what I had sort of helped create a framework for until we were in it. And I think nobody really did until it was sort of underway and the space had been created, and we realized, oh my God, this is like living in a different world where both there's anger at the conditions that we're still trapped in, and a capacity to lift your sights above the day, the routine in every day. And it doesn't mean that people then don't get quickly brought back to earth, because we haven't actually changed the economy and the social relations in a fundamental way that it could be lasting. And people very quickly went back to, well, what comes next? Oh, some people, we got to vote. Other people were like, oh, we can do a boycott of some, you know, some institutions and stuff. And, which, you know, it's fine if people, you know, want to do that. But there was a brief, like, you know, 2-day space that people are still have one foot in of how beautiful and free they could be. And as part of that freedom, a ferocity of needing sort of to overthrow systems of exploitation.
You know, I was just thinking about this as you were saying it. It's, you know, there's that point that you've made, and I think we just, I alluded to it, the point about the what if part of this is the what if story, which I think is really important in relation to the people that are in it and how it sort of changed them being part of this, it sounds like. But then, and I'm also wondering too, is the what if you also did, even though this was not the main thing you were doing, was going out to these other neighborhoods, but there was an element of when you went through there, I did see that you went into some places where people were living, and it's kind of, you know, I can only imagine what people thought when they saw you guys walk marching in or something, you know. And I'd like to talk about that a little bit, because what if is a very important, but very, it also has some broadness to it, but it's also got a very important point behind it. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, we went into these neighborhoods, and the one big regret I have about the project is that on the second day we got slowed down and we couldn't go into this one other neighborhood that I wanted to go to. We just didn't have enough time to complete the full march, and we cut out this one neighborhood, and I'll get back to that in a second. But we did go into, you know, we started in sort of a neighborhood that was, in 1811, it was the slave quarters for the plantation where the rebellion is credited as having started. And up until the 1950s and 60s, there were sharecroppers living in there, and it's now a poor black part of La Place. And you know, we went through there just very briefly, but people were both slightly bemused, but also, wow, this is really interesting. I've never seen sort of, you know, black people armed with, I mean, you know, antiquated weapons, but looking like an army, a liberating army. And what does that pose for the present of how people think about freedom? And then when we got to a neighborhood that's, you know, farther down the road, which we did spend more time in, a lot of these neighborhoods are very segregated, and principally around class lines, but also around racial lines. And so in this one neighborhood, the nicer section of this one neighborhood was near the Mississippi River. So this reenactment was moving from upriver to downriver, and is the direction, but the river was the thing that connected. It was the highway in 1811, and River Road runs next to it, and the levee runs next to it. And a lot of times we were on that system, like going downriver, even if we were on land. But in 1811, it was really important that the big house, the houses were close to the river for a lot of different reasons. And the agriculture, the crop, the sugar, went back away from the river. And so nowadays the plots, you know, the tracts of land are kind of divided on almost a plantation system, but the nicer parts are often near the river, and then the poorer sections are further off it. So in this one area, there is this, you know, big houses. They're not like mansions, but they're big. And then you cross the train tracks quite literally, and you're this one place. I mean, there are three old trailers that, you know, look like they might, you know, leak if it rained and stuff, and people are living in them. And then the rest of the community, which is a little bit further away, is still pretty poor. And in this particular neighborhood, it's not just black. I mean, it's you know, poor white and Latino and black in this neighborhood. But the first place she hit is sort of this black section with these three trailers. And we ended up talking with one of the people who lived there, and she said, look, this land has been in my family for three generations. Nobody ever comes here to do anything like this. I really love what you guys are doing. And so there was an element of just somebody is paying attention to her and to them, but also posing questions about, wow, you know, we could live differently. We're, you know, I as an individual could be different, but more importantly, we could have different social relations collectively if we change the world. And it was, you know, I am reading a little bit into some of her thought process, but she was really overjoyed that we were here and that it was like this, you know, this again is sort of like a black liberating army had come to town. And it was like, wow, what is this? But this is super cool.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with artist Dred Scott about his most recent work, Slave Rebellion Reenactment. You were going to talk about something that you said that where you had to cut out one neighborhood.
Yeah, so we had to cut out. So I was going to say this other neighborhood, this neighborhood called New Sarpy, which is just one of the towns, and it also is segregated. The segregation there is both back to is also back to front. So in the front part that's closest to the river is more affluent, and it was not as wealthy. There aren't mansions, but they're nice houses. And then the further you get from the river is the black section. And it's poor. It's, you know, there are, you know, some, you know, houses there, but a lot of them are trailers built up on cinder block and, you know, open trenches for sewers. And it's just, you know, like a different world. And, you know, we really, really wanted to get there, but it wasn't possible. And that's the regret, because at that place, that was the largest black community we could have been in. Where I think that we would have, and when we've driven through at about the same time of day in previous weeks, people are outside, and my assumption is that some of them, you know, don't have much of a job to go to, and I could be wrong; it's speculative. But it, you know, this is midday, and people, you know, are hanging out in their porches and stuff. And so the day we were going was Saturday, actually, and so it just, I think we would have been met with, you know, people who would have been very intrigued by what was going on, and we couldn't get there, and that's a shame, because I, you know, it's like at that point the army was being building and more cohesive and excited and jubilant, the weather was nice, and it would have been, you know, this, you know, tale of two cities in a certain sense, separated by a train track, and where one section would probably have really been overjoyed to have us there.
Mm-hmm. What about now? This is we're getting close to, but not quite at the point where we're going to have to end. But I did want to ask you this, and I'll come back to the main action. But you also ended this in New Orleans, and let's talk a little bit about why you wanted to end it in New Orleans and what happened there.
Yeah. So as I said, we went to the old U.S. Mint, which is in New Orleans. In 1811, New Orleans was a fortified city. There were five forts that surrounded it, and one of them was Fort St. Charles, which is on the location where the Mint is now. And in 1811, there was an advanced detachment of enslaved people who were trying to seize that fort so there would be weapons available when people got down out of the slave labor camps, which are known as plantations, and so they could have weapons to seize the city. And that wasn't successful, but it was, you know, part of a brilliant strategy. And so we wanted to honor that. We wanted to go there, and we wanted to then get to Congo Square. And Congo Square is a place where, you know, without it and a couple places like it, you don't get modern American music. Enslaved people on Sunday were allowed, on most Sundays from the early 1800s to the mid-1800s, were allowed to gather and do traditional, you know, ceremony, singing, dancing, wear traditional clothing. And through that, the rhythms that came from West Africa were preserved that laid the foundation for jazz, blues, rock and roll, rhythm and blues, funk, hip-hop, disco, bounce, trap, trance. I mean, all of that, all the music, you know, that we think of as American music, it comes from these African roots. It's hybridized. I mean, if you don't have the rest of America, you don't get that either. But without that, you don't get it. And so, we wanted to end in celebration there, sort of really, you know, celebrating the heroes of the courage and determination and plotting and planning of these rebels. And so we also wanted to be in New Orleans so that people from the city could see it, because that's, you know, where most people are. These river parishes are not so densely populated. New Orleans has, you know, 300,000 or 400,000 people, and some of them could see this. And we marched through the French Quarter, and it was inspiring. I mean, as I said at the Mint, it was the most exciting, dynamic, liberated part of the whole reenactment. It was so beautiful. That would happen sort of spontaneously. And I, you know, we have a little bit of that footage on our website now. People should check it out. It's slave-revolt.com. And you just see a fierceness and a determination and a joy that was just beautiful. And then we, you know, we walked through the French Quarter, which is sort of the touristy section of town. And it was, you know, there was a slave army marching through you know, the French Quarter with machetes clanging and banging and you know, drumming. It was amazing. And then we go into Congo Square, and as we got there, you know, they had some sort of traditional African spiritualists, you know, the mamas that were all dressed in white with white staves, and they sort of led us into Congo Square, at which point the army was flipping to a cultural celebration. It was beautiful. And then we get on stage, and, you know, the sort of people go on stage, and we did Janelle Monáe's song, How You Tell Me About, which she kind of gave to the people to be part of demonstrations and calling out the names of people killed by police. But we changed it up a bit, and we shouted out the names of many of the rebels that were participant in and led the 1811 revolt. So it's like, Hell You Tell Me About, you know, say his name, Charles Dolan, say his name, Charles Dolan. And going down, say his name, Jupiter, say his name, Jupiter, say her name, Marie Rose, say her name, Marie Rose. And just, and all the people, well, many, like about 50 people or 60 people who participated in the reenactment got on stage and each said one name, you know, with a gun or a machete or a sickle in their hand. And the musicians were Delfeo Marcellus, you know, of the Marcellus family, and their band was Tight. And they had a singer also, Grace, whose name I'm forgetting, you know, who just sort of led it. And it was, it was powerful. The audience, it was, you know, hundreds of people in Congo Square were just looking at this and awaiting us and wanting to go with us on this journey. And it was, and even before we got to the calling out the names, there was a beautiful poem by Sonny Patterson, a really great spoken word artist, which talked about slavery and enslavement and the history of the United States, including calling out how some Christianity has been used to sort of rationalize and justify that institution. It was just a powerful way to celebrate and end, close out this sort of, you know, 2-day, 24-mile trek.
One more question, and it's sort of, you've spoken a little bit to this already, but I wanted to, because it's something I was thinking about all weekend. And ever since we actually started speaking about this, this is something that really, that sort of really got to me. And you know, you talk about this being, the importance of this being a what-if story. And I kept thinking about the way that it must have impacted the people themselves who were marching. Not in this particular thing, but in the early on, the joy of rising up against all the horror that you face day in and day out, and you know that so many other people are facing day in and day out, the joy of rising up against that. And you brought that together. I remember you telling me that you were really trying to bring that together in a certain sense of it being recreating another what if story. And this whole question of the vision of emancipation and how that actually manifested itself in this. And it really did. It wasn't the point of going out with this in particular. You did the thing about the, you know, you showed the people going to fight, the taking up the arms to do this, but you were also calling on people who were part of this and people who might hear about this or see it. You know, there's something bigger that actually you were posing to people too. And I thought that was really important in terms of this what if story.
Yeah. Well, it was really trying to get people to, in the present, to step outside of what they think is possible for social change and to dream a little bit. And on that basis, to then reassess what's possible, to not just settle for, you know, oh, this is what we think we can achieve. Let's just, you know, put our heads down and maybe we can get Bernie in as president or some, you know, flip Congress or, you know, have some reforms of, you know, a murderous police system and still leave it in place. And to really get people to just like, look at, well, these people, the only way they could really get free, even though people escaped and even though people, you know, had maroon colonies, the only way to really get free in 1811 was to overthrow the system of slavery. That, you know, if you even escaped, it would have been great and righteous. But if the whole country was still predicated upon turning black people into enslaved people, and you could be picked up at any time, you couldn't really be free. And so these people, you know, identified the problem was that they were enslaved. The solution was to end slavery. Let's figure out how to do that. And that thought process, even though it would have been very difficult, and ultimately they weren't successful in achieving that goal, but the thought process and the courage and daring and planning is something that I think modern-day people could learn from. And I hope to create sort of a framework so that people could have a space to begin to dream about those questions, which I think for the present is really, really necessary. I mean, you know, this project was started before sort of a worldwide fascist movement had gained steam that also has, you know, Trump in power here. And it would have been a really great project if it was done, you know, even 3 years ago. But now it has particular resonance as people are really having to confront, you know, there's a fascist in the White House, and it's not just him. There's a whole fascist movement that's being sort of brought forward, and fascist form of rule is being consolidated. And what do people do? Where do we dream? Do we just think, oh yeah, maybe we can wait 2 years and you know, get some, you know, Democrat in office that we'll conciliate with and go along with much of the fascist agenda, because that's not going away, short of it being defeated? Or do we really dream and reach for the stars? And again, this, I, you know, this is artwork. I don't want it to be instrumentalized as to saying that this is really a project about ending fascism, or this is really a project about ending mass incarceration, or about reparations. It's not that. It's art. And people should, you know, have their sights lifted. And then on that basis, they can go do the change that they think needs to happen, and hopefully can stay in a space where they can imagine and dream and think what if in ways that is sometimes difficult to do outside of the realm of art.
And in your case, it's something that you always, in your case, it's something that you always, in my mind, managed to accomplish, man. And everything I've seen you work on over the past many years, just remarkable. And this is something that really blew my mind. And thank you very much, man.
Well, thank you. It blew my mind, too. But thank you, and it was good to talk with you. And, yeah, catch you after the next piece, I guess.
Yeah, and stay in touch, man, because I want to hear what happens with this. And if the film comes out around this and all, let's figure out what we can do, all right? All right, man. Take care, Dre.
Okay. Bye. Bye.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we were just talking with artist Dred Scott. And we've been talking with him about his brand new piece, Slave Rebellion Reenactment. And this is a very, very powerful piece. And people should go to his website, which is slave-revolt.com. All right, go there and you can begin to check out some of the reports he has from this. And also, I'm sure as he develops what he's going to do with this whole thing after a, it sounded like a really powerful event over the last weekend. And after he's decided what to do with this, you'll definitely be able to find that out on his site, all right? And we will be following it as well, so you'll be able to hear about it from us on The Michael Slate Show. All right, wherever you are, we'll be getting that out. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. That was Outer National with Todos Somos Ilegales, We Are All Illegals. In September, Trump announced his decision to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA, the Obama-era program that kept undocumented immigrants who'd been brought to the United States as children from being deported. Now, seven DACA recipients were arrested in the offices of Democratic Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and Representative Carlos Corbello, demanding that they, along with other members of Congress who previously expressed support for Dreamers, live up to their word. The DACA recipients are demanding that members of Congress block any spending bill that does not include a Clean Dream Act. Here to talk with us about this is Bossy Lisa Alonso, who is a volunteer with the Our Dream Coalition. Bossy, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Sure, and I want to start off by saying that someone called me and said, man, have you seen this? This is so important. There's so much that on the line here, and there's so much bravery, and it's something that people everywhere have to pay attention to, respect, and actually think about what it means for them in the conditions we're living in today. So that's why I wanted to talk with you about this action. So why don't you tell us about the recent action that was taken by these seven students and others who are DACA recipients?
Sure. So on Friday, seven undocumented youth and one ally went to Senator Schumer's office and Representative Corbello's office. The reason why they went there was because these are two people, especially Senator Schumer, you know, who has positioned himself to be a leader and who has multiple times said that he stands with Dreamers, But just last week, he was already backtracking on that and saying that the DREAM Act could be brought up for a vote later on. That's something that, you know, is totally different than what he has been saying up until a few days ago. And these really brave people took action because we're asking that this issue no longer gets kicked along down the road, right? We've been waiting for over 10 years. This has been a long time in the making. People are losing their status every single day, about 120 people, and we just can't wait right now. And if they say that they stand with Dreamers, then we need them to prove it.
Now, when you said that it's a very dangerous situation for people right now, why?
Because people are already losing their status. So there are about 120 DACA recipients every day that lose status. As we are seeing with our brave comrades that are in jail right now, DACA is no longer a guarantee protection. ICE has been alerted about one of our colleagues in jail and puts the entire group at risk. So ICE could potentially detain them. Every day that they spend in jail heightens the risk of ICE intervening and perhaps detaining them. And, you know, this is something that can be fixed, right? All we're asking is that Senator Schumer and Representative Corbello come out and publicly pledge that they have the votes necessary to stop any spending bill that doesn't include the DREAM Act.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me this, because actually, I mean, there's a lot of times in what I've been reading about it since yesterday, the day before, it really hit me a lot that there's a question here of when you talk about what the congressional people are saying, what the system is saying to people is very different than what people are actually, what the youth and other people, the dreamers are actually demanding. And there's a certain amount of righteousness that's really important that's on the side of the people. And there's a certain amount of, you know, just dishonesty and, you mm-hmm. know, just flim-flamming on the side of the system. Let's talk about that a little bit, about the way mm-hmm. that's fallen out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. This is something that we are told some things privately, we're told some things publicly. But essentially what we want is for something to happen already. It's never been our time, right? This issue has never, it's never been the right time for any type of immigration bill to come up. The last time we had any sort of immigration relief was in 1986. And we really just can't wait. We need the DREAM Act now to protect everyone who is losing status. And we always knew that DACA was only a temporary fix, right? Because that was something that we have to renew every couple of years. And we knew that there was always a possibility that if a president was in office who didn't have the same views as President Obama, could revoke that at any time, like it has happened. Politicians have told us, especially Democrats, that they are on our side. And this is something that we're constantly told, we have been told for many, many years, that we should focus on Republicans. But let's not forget that in 2010, the DREAM Act failed because five Democrats didn't vote with their party. And so we just want to make sure that everyone remembers that and that no one forgets that, and that Senator Schumer actually whips his party to not vote for the spending bill if it doesn't include the DREAM Act. And we also need his guarantee that he has the votes necessary to make this happen, to make the DREAM Act happen this week.
You know, that's one of the things that actually really impressed me, is that it seemed to me that what you folks were saying from the get-go was sort of, look, we've played around with these politicians. This is not something that we can continue to play with, that this is a very serious matter for many, many. I mean, look, we're talking about how many hundreds of thousands of people are
800,000.
Yeah, yeah. And this is something that really has got to be resolved, because this is a massive crime against humanity when they're talking about going in and just rolling down mm-hmm. the tracks and deporting people. I mean, just picking them up. And it really can. People don't think about this. It really can go from what it is today, where you're having deportations that are sort of, you know, behind the screen. Sometimes they burst out, but it's actually kind of quiet and nobody's mm-hmm. really focused on a lot of it, to when you're actually having railroad cars filled with people and deporting them.
Mm-hmm. And that's something that they can't turn away from, right? What happened on Friday, we're showing them this is what's going to happen. This is going to be our reality if nothing is fixed. Right. And we're also asking that we get the DREAM Act, but with no negative attachments. We don't want any money for Border Patrol. We don't want money for the wall. We don't want our communities to be criminalized, because my parents are not criminals. My parents are the original dreamers. And so we want the DREAM Act, but not at the cost of our families. And that's something that they can't turn away from. Senator Schumer, Representative Corbello, and the rest of Congress will go home and spend a very lovely time with their family for Christmas. But our families, that's not going to be the case. A lot of us go home every single night and don't know if we're going to see our families the next day. And that's the reality that we live in. And I know it's hard for someone who doesn't understand the reality that we live in to wrap their heads around, but that's what's happening. And the fact that seven people are sitting in DC jail right now and who have been exposed to ICE, that's just a reality that Congress can't push aside. They have to face that because they were arrested and they're in DC jail for simply asking that Senator Schumer really prove that he is the leader he says he is and that he really stands with Dreamers. And the same thing with Representative Curbelo, who says that he stands with Dreamers.
Now, you've said a couple times that ICE has already been alerted as to the presence of these youth in jail and that the protesters could be deported. They could actually be picked up right now without even, you know, just them walking in and getting deported like that?
So I'm not sure how the legality works. So we know that ICE is aware of one of our colleagues who is in jail right now. So they have the ability to request that once they are released from jail, that they be detained, right? That they be held for ICE pickup. And they can be transferred to a detention center. And that entire process will just be triggering their immigration hold and could possibly put them in deportation proceedings.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you think about this, and it really stunned me, that this is actually a fast-moving machine, as you've been indicating. But just so people know, 11,000 people have lost their status so far, and every day 122 more people lose their DACA status. So every day without DACA actually threatens deportations for hundreds of people, literally, right?
Absolutely, yeah. As soon as we lose our status, we are exposed to deportation, right? And that is especially dangerous for people at border towns because of the interaction with Border Patrol. One thing that Senator Schumer seems to forget is that New York is a border town, right? We border Canada. So there's plenty of people, plenty of farm workers who get deported all the time from interaction with Border Patrol. So losing our protection is horrible, but the other thing is also that we won't be able to work anymore. This is going to be one of the most, a massive layoff if you think about it like that. We have 800,000 people who are no longer going to be able to work to contribute to society and provide for their families.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the impact on people's families beyond the providing for their families? But what about the impact on people like, you know, if some students are picked up and deported and or just picked up by ICE or whatever, and they're run out like this, what is the impact on the families that are left behind? Is it, do they then become, you know, susceptible to ICE and all these and deportations and whatnot?
Mm-hmm. And we simply don't know, right? The government said, come out, come forward, come out of the shadows. We're going to grant you this protection. Don't be afraid. We won't use your personal information against you, but we don't know if that's going to be true or not, right, with this administration. This administration could potentially utilize the information that we use when we apply for DACA to go after us and our families.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Bossy Lisa Alonso, who is a volunteer with the Our Dream Coalition. And we're talking about a very courageous and important stand taken by seven DACA recipients and one other volunteer to stand up and say that they demand that DACA be reinstated now. Now, tell us this. You know, when you're talking about the people being in jail and all this, it really struck me that there was something, I read some stuff about, it wasn't just people getting arrested like you normally get arrested in a demonstration. You're arrested and then you're, you know, you might be booked on a minor charge, you might be let out and then you go to court later, something like this. But this was actually, people were actually thrown in jail and they made a decision that morally and politically, they were not going to bend to the rules. And they've been undertaking a lot of actions, I understand, in the jail themselves, right?
Mm-hmm. So they were arrested on Friday. Today is the first day that they spent in jail. They have also been engaging in the hunger strike. So their bellies are empty, but we know that they've said that their hearts are full with the strength of the community. We are showing up to show them that we are there, that we stand with them. But again, they can come out tomorrow, right? All we need is Senator Schumer and Representative Curbelo to do their job.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Bossy Lisa Alonso, who is a volunteer with the Our Dream Coalition. And we're talking about a very courageous and important stand taken by seven DACA recipients and one other volunteer to stand up and say that they demand that DACA be reinstated now. As I was thinking about this, and as I was thinking back about what we've just been talking about, you know, I don't want to let these people off the hook. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about the hypocrisy of the Democrats. You have Schumer and all these people, and there's a certain amount of the stench of hypocrisy surrounding everything they're doing in relation to this. Let's talk about that a little.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I come from New York, and when people think of New York, they think of New York City and its, you know, welcoming policies towards immigrants. But I grew up right outside of New York in Westchester County, which is, you know, a little more conservative. And I think that people don't really see New York as a place that's hostile to immigrants, but, you know, anything outside of New York City can be a hostile place. We've been told throughout this very long journey that now is not our time. It's never been our time. Immigration has never, it's never been the right time to do something about immigration. When it's midterm years, they say we can't do that because, you know, it's going to harm Democrats who are running for re-election. For example, when President Obama came in, he said that immigration was going to be his priority. Latinos came out in support because, you know, in addition, yes, to education, to health care, he said he was going to do something for us, and he didn't. We were put on the back burner, and they said, wait, now is not your time. In 2010, when we lost the DREAM Act because of five Democrats, they said it was because of the re-elections, right? They were facing tough re-elections. But we're with you, and we'll do something. And then when DACA happened, you know, that was from pressure from our community. We had people sitting in President Obama's re-election offices to bring attention to the fact that he hadn't kept his promises. And so he gave us DACA, but because of the work that the community put in. And then we wanted something more permanent, right? Because we knew that, in a sense, that was just breadcrumbs. But again, they told us, now is not your time. Now here we are in 2017, and we have an administration who is revving up their deportation machine, who they're deporting people indiscriminately. And they're telling us again, this is not the time. So then when is the time? If we couldn't do it under a Democratic president when we had the majority in both houses, and now we can't do it now with a president who is coming after me and my family, then when is the time? We can't wait anymore.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And what kind of response have you been getting among people that hear about this? Have there been people coming up to support?
Yes, we have been receiving an outpouring of support from the community. There's been more DACA recipients who are just inspired by this big sacrifice that these seven people and one ally are taking. They're literally putting their livelihood on the line. And that's just something really inspiring. And it's a shame, frankly, that seven people have to risk deportation in order to move leaders in Congress, right? I really wish that Congress could just have a quarter of the strength that these people are showing right now.
Well, that'd be, there's a big, long, hard wish that you're not going to see, sister. I got to tell you that, okay? That's just not going to happen. But here's the thing, because overall, when I heard about this, I was very moved. And I thought, here are people whose, their freedom, their safety, their very lives are at threat here. If they
Absolutely.
Dare to stand up and do this, their lives are at threat. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk about that because it's like there's an overall importance of this action. Saying this at this time under this regime, and we have a fascist regime in power, and to stand up against them like this is not only brave, but extremely important in terms of the example it sets for people everywhere else. Let's talk about mm-hmm. that, the overall importance of this action in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And why people took it now.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that these folks are giving us is hope. That we can stand up and we can fight back, even under this administration. We may not be able to vote. We may not be able to pay, you know, high-power lobbyists, but we have the power of our stories, and that's what they're using, right? And they're using their stories in hopes to motivate the American public to stand with us, because we can't do this alone. We need both affected community members and our allies to stand with us. We need congressional representatives to realize that my friends right now have been in jail for 4 days now. ICE knows about them. And this is something that they can end. Like, we're just asking that they finally do their job after two decades.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talked about the stories, and I think that's very important as well. Let's talk about that. When you say their stories actually can impact people, give people a sense of what those stories are.
Mm-hmm. So, for example, we have one person who is very young. Her parents are undocumented. They're both farm workers. They work from sundown. They get treated unfairly. Their job is backbreaking. But here she is, you know, speaking up for herself and speaking up for her family and just taking that risk because she knows that even if something happens to her, even if she has to suffer for a week and to get Congress to act, what we're going to get is hopefully protection for her, but not at the expense of her parents, her migrant farm working parents.
Mm-hmm. When you say that, I was thinking about that as well. And some of it is when you think about what is it that motivates people overall, because this is not, it's not an easy step to take. I mean, people are stepping out of whatever way that they've been able to sort of make their way through this society, faced with the removal of the Dreamers Act, all this other stuff, and Trump's moves to deport people. All of these things, yet people keep doing this. And that's one of the reasons I was really so, I think it's so important for people to understand what people are facing and the fact that in the face of all that, that they have the heart and the soul and the thinking, mm-hmm. the broadness of mind and the dedication to actually stand up against this regime and the horror that it's bringing down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a saying, you know, when they take everything away from you, they even take your fear. That's a saying, you know, very popular in Latin America. We've been pushed to the brink where our backs are against the wall. We are at this point laying all our cards on the table. We are, you know, asking, like laying our hearts bare. We're saying, you know, we need your help. We need the American public to make those calls, to hold their members of Congress accountable. And we need our undocumented community to stand up. We're not going to let them drive us back into the shadows. Like, that's what they're going to do. We've been able to come out of the shadows. DACA was a win from the community, right? We won DACA because we had people, like the people sitting in jail right now, who risked a lot. Even with no protection against deportation, they participated in civil disobedience, and they were arrested, and they could have been deported. But they put everything on the line to fight for all of us, for all the 800,000 people who have DACA, and for all their families.
Mm-hmm. And that part about for all their families and all the people that aren't their families but are part of their bigger family, because I know this is one thing I read in connection with this, is that it was said that this isn't just about the permanent protections for undocumented youth, but actually people are acting for all 11 million undocumented people in the U.S. Let's talk about that for a minute.
Mm-hmm. Just to put things into perspective a little bit, I am also a DACA recipient. And the day that DACA was announced in 2012, I was coming home from my waitressing job. I was in college, working three jobs, trying to finish school. I didn't know what I was going to do. After I graduated from school, I thought that I was going to have this diploma, this pretty diploma, and just hang it on the wall and not be able to do anything with it. And I got home that day, and my mom very excitedly came in. And she was like, you have to come watch TV. You know, President Obama is going to make an announcement about Dreamers. And she was really excited. And I remember being in the room with her and my father, and we were watching the television. And as President Obama came out, you know, my mom, who has broken English, you know, was clinging onto every word. And then he started mentioning the things that would qualify people for DACA. And in my head, I was just doing a mental checklist, like, yes, I qualify for this. You know, I made the deadline. I made the cut. And after the press conference was over, we all just, you know, started crying and we all hugged each other. And then I had an immense sense of guilt where I said, you know, it doesn't feel right that I get this protection and that you don't. And my mom said, I don't care what happens to me. All I care is that you're okay and that you're safe. And that's what we're fighting for. They're not criminals. You know, my parents are the original Dreamers. They came here escaping violence to give me a better life. And like my family, there are hundreds of thousands of other families just like that. So we're saying, you know, we deserve this protection. We've grown up here. This is our home. But at the same time, we're not willing to jeopardize the livelihood of our families.
Absolutely, absolutely. One last question. What's happening now through Friday, and how can people plug in?
Yeah, for anyone that, you know, wants to stand up, wants to plug in, visit fightforourdream.org. Again, that's fightforourdream.org. Follow us using the hashtags Our Dream and Clean Dream, and stand up and host something in your district. If you can't come to D.C., host host a vigil for acknowledging the sacrifice that these DACA recipients are taking. Hold a sit-in in your congressional representative's office. Hold them accountable. Let them know that this is an important issue to you, the voter, and that we can't wait for the DREAM Act. This is the best time for us to get something. This is the best time where we have some leverage to get the Clean DREAM Act. And we know that if the DREAM Act gets brought up in February or in January, then it's not going to be anything good. It's going to contain a lot of things that's going to be harmful to our communities. We're tired of playing politics. If you are going to let us be taken away silently in the night, you know, there's a saying that you can judge a country by how they treat their homeless, by how they treat their prisoners, by how they treat the people who are the most marginalized. And we are those people. So if you're not going to fight for us and they come for us, and once they're done with us, they're going to come for you.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And there's the big question about where the hell is your humanity? That's mm-hmm. huge. All right, Bossy, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. So happy to be here again.
Yeah. And listen, let's stay in touch because I want to follow this as it works out. All right.
Okay. Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you. Take care now.
Okay. Bye.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Bossy Lisa Alonzo. And Bossy is a volunteer for the Our Dream Coalition. And we've been talking about the recent move by seven Dreamers to stand up and demand that Congress pass the DREAM Act immediately. Well, that brings us to the end of yet another show, and I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board op, Teddy Robinson, and all of you who tune in each and every week and stay tuning in. And if you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with a little more from Todos Somos Ilegales by Outer National. Talk to you again next week.
I dream of fire, but I sleep so cold. I raise a red flag on the Alamo. I want to show you how our lives unfold. Deep inside. Todos somos ilegales. Todos somos ilegales. With the fire once, our time has come. Todos somos ilegales. Fighting for a new way and a new day. Todos somos ilegales.